but in the Middle Ages, they had no problem. There was a play on words between the wound, the vulna in his side, and the vulva. But try saying that to your friends from those communities.
And can you write us and tell us what they said? At the heart of Christianity is the doctrine of incarnation, the event in which God takes on flesh in the person of Jesus Christ. Throughout much of Christianity's history, the how, when, and where of this doctrine has been contested. And tonight, that is no different as we discuss how the incarnation emboldened and inspired medieval Christian women. Welcome to Theology Live, a podcast and live event that highlights the playful dance between theology and contemporary life. Today's guest is Dr. Emily Holmes, Associate Professor of Religion and Philosophy at Christian Brothers University. I am the Reverend Broderick Greer, curate at Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church and School, and this is Theology Live. So, Dr. Holmes, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me. It's delightful to be here.
As we begin all of our interviews, I have this question for you. Who are you, and why do you do what you do?
Okay. So, I'm a theologian, which is always fun to say, but it's not the kind of thing you want to say on an airplane, someone you're sitting next to. So I'm a theologian, and I'm a professor of religious studies at Christian Brothers University, and I do what I do because I care about people's lives, and I care about women's lives and their well-being, and I think what first motivated me to get into theology was this question of how women relate to the divine in the Christian tradition, because Christianity has overwhelmingly focused on God the Father, a male savior. Until very recently, it hasn't ordained women or granted them the authority to teach theology. So I think growing up in the church, I felt excluded by that tradition, and I couldn't quite find my place in it. There were things that appealed to me, but I couldn't find my place. But then when I was in college, I spent a year living in Europe and visiting cathedrals and museums and looking at amazing artwork, particularly medieval and Renaissance art, and seeing that women were everywhere in those paintings. Saints, Mary, the Mother of God, in the space of the cathedrals themselves. And I realized that there was something that I had missed in what was kind of my adolescent dismissal of the Christian tradition. So that got me thinking about theology, and I applied to graduate school, began studying theology, and read a lot of systematic, constructive liberation theologies. Feminist theology, of course, was fairly important to me. But I really found my area when I encountered the medieval women mystics, and began researching their lives and their writings in particular. So I think that passion has extended into my research, my teaching, and it grounds what I've been working on lately, which is more food justice and theology of food and eating. So that's a long-winded answer.
No, that's a perfect answer. So what resonated with you about medieval Christian women?
It was initially the fact that they were writing theology. It wasn't necessarily recognized as theology at the time, but the fact that they were writing accounts of their experience, of their visions, they were writing didactic theology, instructing others in the spiritual life. And the question that really motivated me was, what authorized them to do that? What empowered them to do that? There are women who have written throughout the Christian tradition, but it's fairly rare, and we're not very familiar with them. So why was there this moment in the 13th, 14th centuries when there were so many women writing of their experiences? They weren't ordained as priests. They weren't allowed to enter universities. They had no formal education. So what actually empowered them to write theology? And the more I researched their lives and read their writings, it was something about the incarnation that spoke to them. The historian Carolyn Walker Bynum writes about how in the medieval period, women's devotional piety came to really focus on the body of Jesus and to see in him a body that they recognized and identified with. His body was wounded, it bled, it gave birth on the cross. When the water and blood pours out of his side, that was widely understood to refer to giving birth to the church and the sacraments, baptism, the Eucharist emerging from his side. He fed others with his own body, the way women breastfeed. So he served others, you know, his body became food. So they saw something in him that provided a kind of mirror for their own subjectivity, their own sense of personhood. And what I discuss in the book, The Flesh Made Word, that it's a kind of inverted paradigm for their own writings. That is, when they see Christ, he is the Word made flesh, right? This is from the prologue to the fourth gospel, that he is the Word made flesh who dwelt among us. And in response to that Word made flesh, their flesh can become word. It can emerge in writings, in speech. So that this gave the theological justification, really, for their writings.
Did they understand that that's what they were doing, or is this something that we were able to kind of look back and say, oh, well, there's some themes here in these women and the way they were talking about God and themselves?
It's hard to know exactly what they understood that they were doing. I mean, there were some networks of women's communities in Northern Europe where they shared their writings and encouraged and supported one another. It emerges as a theme in their writings, probably more from our perspective looking back. But they were doing something really innovative at the time, because the kinds of writings that they engaged in played with the boundaries of different genres. So they wrote poetry, letters, songs, allegorical dialogues, not what you would recognize if, you know, if you're studying medieval theology and you're reading Thomas Aquinas, for instance. It doesn't look like that, and nor does it look like the sermons that are coming out of monasteries. It's they're using secular literature, songs of the troubadours, epic poems as the model for how to think about themselves in relationship to God. So I'll give you one example. Hadewijk of Brabant describes God as Lady Love. And the idea of calling God Lady Love comes straight out of troubadour literature. So she has a feminine name for God. God is a lady rather than a lord, right? Personified love, and describes herself as a knight who is seeking after his lady. So they're playing with genre, they're playing with gender. There's a kind of queering that's happening in their writings. So to what degree is that self-conscious, or is it just the medieval period? They're not as hung up on some of the categories that we have in a postmodern age. That's hard to say.
And was there pushback again when this was happening, or is that just a wild question?
No, that's a great question. And yes, there was. I'll give you a couple of examples that I talk about in my book. Angela Foligno, when she began having visions and experiences of God, she went on a pilgrimage to Assisi to visit the Church of St. Francis. And she had an extraordinary religious experience and began screaming uncontrollably on the floor at the doors of the cathedral. And her cousin, who was her confessor, saw her and was ashamed and embarrassed and thought that she was probably possessed by the devil, and began to ask questions and investigate her experiences. So she was under suspicion. right? Now, that's actually a good thing for us because for that reason, we know her story. We have a book about her life that he wrote. But there was that kind of pushback about her experience. And the other example I want to share with you is about Marguerite Perret, who was burned at the stake as a heretic for writing a book of theology, of mystical theology, in 1310. And it's a fantastic book called The Mirror of Simple Souls. But she wrote it in French. She distributed it. Her bishop saw it and said, "You've got to stop sharing this book with people. It's too advanced. It falls. It says things that are too bold." She then disobeyed her bishop. She sent the book to different authorities, a Franciscan, a theologian at the University of Paris. They read it and said, "Okay, it's orthodox, but not everyone really should read this because it does push the boundaries too much." She was then, and it's not exactly clear why this happened, but she was arrested, and because she had already been warned once, now she's considered a relapsed heretic. She was imprisoned for over a year. She refused to answer the questions at the trial to begin the proceedings, so they condemned her on the basis of the things she wrote in her book. And so she was burned at the stake on June 1st, 1310, the Place de Grève in Paris, and a contemporary historian was chronicling it. And he called her a fake woman. Not clear why, because she was not, I think that the reason actually is because she wasn't obeying the norms of femininity, right? She wouldn't submit. She was writing theology and persisted, even when it was going too far.
So she would have been on the banned books list.
Yes.
Of the 14th century.
Right.
Basically.
Right. But it's more to the story. The book had already been copied and translated. And so it continued to circulate anonymously. They took her name off of it. You may have heard that anonymous was a woman. In this case, it's really true. Like, this book was widely read without her name attached to it. It was read in monasteries. And then it wasn't until 1945 that a scholar made the connection that this book of spiritual, of mystical theology was actually written by the heretic, Marguerite Perret. So it had been published with the imprimatur, with the stamp that it was, you know, orthodox teaching until that connection was made. So it raises this question of how power and gender influence the outcome of her trial rather than the content of the teachings themselves.
Fascinating. And that, I mean, could be applied so broadly to so many things that we just don't have time to talk about tonight. So I need to stay here with the script. You were talking earlier about how incarnation, the body of Jesus, became an authority, an authorization, or a permission because women were identifying with him physically. Can you say a little bit more about that and what kinds of connections that maybe some modern groups might find with that, mm-hmm. If you can make that stretch as well?
So one way to think about this is with what's been called the divine exchange. And this goes back to some of the church fathers, like Athanasius, that God became human so that we might become God. So the purpose of the incarnation is divinization or deification, the becoming divine of humanity. It's not that God became human in order to die, but God became human in order that we might become God. This is salvation. This is the becoming divine of humanity. And Angela of Foligno, I mentioned earlier, she says something similar, but she makes it very personal. She says, "My God became flesh in order to make me God." Now, that doesn't mean that she is God, you know, omnipotent, but it means that she is experiencing God in her own body and becoming divine. And that becoming divine is a process, but it helps theologically ground what I see as an inclusive understanding of the incarnation, that the incarnation was not a one-time event that happened in first century Palestine, but it is a possibility, a potential that happens in all of us through our practices, our spiritual practices, our ethical practices. So whenever we serve the poor, we're practicing the incarnation. Whenever we receive Eucharist, we're practicing the incarnation. Through our prayer lives, our participation in liturgy, we are ourselves, our bodies are being transformed, are becoming divine, so that the incarnation doesn't just dwell in one particular male body, but that event opened it up for us to see and experience God in our own bodies, in our lives, in the people we meet, the faces we see, and in the land, in the animals, in the food we eat, in the created world around us.
Which is so present, usually within Eastern Christianity. You know, there were some Eastern writers that basically said that as Jesus took on flesh, that sanctified all flesh. Mm-hmm. You know, when Jesus was baptized, that sanctified all water. Mm-hmm. Which to some extent, that way of thinking and talking about the incarnation has been lost in many ways in the West. That makes Christian faith in some ways very anemic. Unfortunately, I guess, I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and I think the response to that is to retrieve some of these traditions that we've lost sight of, to remember the richness of our tradition. And some of this comes from Protestant anti-Catholicism, you know, the reason that it is impoverished, I think, in the West. But to retrieve these spiritual traditions, and I think you see it in the work of contemporary feminist and liberation theologians, queer theologians who pay more attention to the body and to bodily differences as being sites of encountering the divine through our practices.
Yes. And what I see on Twitter, where I'm very active, is a lot of people from the more authoritative communities or kind of majority communities who treat kind of the queer liberation, womanist, feminist theologians as, I mean, the same way that they treated Marie Perret, is it?
Marguerite
Perret. Because when you actually listen to what these people are saying, it's orthodox. I mean, it's really in line with what the church has said from basically day one. But the person saying it, their body is not orthodox. Like, in some way, they're contesting the orthodoxy of a person's body and identity.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that, I mean, that still happens every day, even in our digital world. So you talked about practices of the incarnation, prayer, the way we relate to land, to food. How do we meet God in our bodies more specifically?
I think it's a practice of cultivating attention, or what Buddhists would call mindfulness. You know, paying attention to the present moment, that God is encountered in the now, in this moment, right now, right here. So cultivating that kind of awareness, and that is a practice. But any of our spiritual or ethical practices are ways to cultivate that attention. And any work for justice, you know, is a way of cultivating that practice, or for peace, or, you know, yoga and singing and dance. And I mean, these are all practices that draw our awareness back to our bodies, back to the present moment, so that we can experience God in that moment.
And yes, that materiality, mm-hmm. You know, I think that's lost as well. So I think, you know, we were talking earlier about grapes and blueberries, and like the average person, myself included, I don't know where those things come from, usually. When I'm at Kroger and buying grapes, probably to some extent out of season. You've done a lot of work around food and land and theology. Could you speak to that, kind of the modern estrangement
Sure.
from the land?
Yeah, we are alienated from the land and from the sources of our lives, you know, from the sources of our sustenance. And of course, that contributes to being alienated from our own bodies. You know, we aren't connected to where our food comes from. For instance, we're eating in ignorance, as Wendell Berry puts it. And technology, for all its wonders, does kind of contribute, I think, to that dislocation or the loss of place, of being rooted in a particular place, and face-to-face connections, embodied connections. So the work I've done around food justice and food theology is about bringing our awareness back to just where does our food come from? Just asking that simple question can open up a whole area, and I do this in my teaching, of learning, of experiential learning, and reconnecting with the place in which we live, the sources of our food, the plants and animals that sustain us through our eating, and through those things, through the soil, through the land, with the divine. And there's that wonderful William Carlos Williams poem that Wendell Berry quotes, that there is nothing to eat, seek it where you will, but the body of the Lord. So that everything we eat, if we can see it, is the body of Christ. Everything is Eucharist. Everything we eat is potentially Eucharist if we can experience it in that way.
That's great. I mean, what else is there to say? That was so perfect. There is a wonderful quote that you introduced to me by Blessed Angela of Foligno. Is that correct?
That's right.
I was so concerned with that Italian word at the end. Okay, Foligno.
Foligno.
This world is pregnant with God, she said. Can you tell us a little bit more about Angela to kind of contextualize that gem of a quote?
Sure. So she was an Italian in the Franciscan tradition. She became a member of the Third Order of St. Francis. So what that means is that she was a laywoman. She wasn't a nun, but her spirituality was shaped by the teachings of St. Francis and the Franciscan friars. And she's the one who went on pilgrimage to Assisi and had this experience where she was screaming and making a scene, essentially. She was a visionary. She had visions, but then she tried to organize visions, graces, gifts of God, where she would have a vision of Christ, for instance, or experience herself on Holy Saturday, entering into the tomb with him and feeling he put his hand on her cheek. So she had these extraordinary experiences as a result of her prayer life and her life in the tradition of St. Francis. And the deeper she went into her spirituality, the more she began to see Christ in everything, to see God in everything. And one extraordinary experience that I always share with my students, and because it's a little bit gross, I'll warn you, but on Good Friday, no, sorry, it was Holy Thursday, she went with her companion to visit the lepers outside her town. So this is in the 13th century, and the lepers live on the outskirts. And they went to wash the feet of the lepers, because foot washing on Holy Thursday. And then as they were there providing this service to the lepers, they decided to drink the water in which they had washed the feet of the lepers. And a scale of skin from one of the lepers got stuck in her throat as she was drinking the water. And she said that it was as sweet as if it was the host, that it tasted to her like the body of Christ. Okay, so it's extreme identification with humility, kind of abjection, and yet she sees Christ in the leper, right? Like that leper is Christ for her at that moment. And I think that's extraordinary. And then another compelling
vision.
That's
one word for it.
This is why I like medieval women. They're always surprising.
yes, that's a great word.
Yeah. And then the quote that I shared with you, that she had a vision where she looked out at the world and exclaimed, "This world is pregnant with God." So that's a kind of sacramental understanding that creation itself is the body of God. God is fully present in the created world, is immanent in the world. And what I love about that is that she uses that metaphor of pregnancy, which is underused in our tradition, oddly, because it's Advent, right? We are anticipating the birth of Christ, and Mary's pregnancy easily becomes a metaphor for pregnancy of the world with God. Hadevik, another woman mystic, took Mary's 9 months of pregnancy as an allegory of the spiritual life, that, you know, as you progress, you're in your faith through these 9 months, you become more divine and ultimately give birth to God. Meister Eckhart talks about the birth of God in the soul. And Martin Luther, in his Christmas prayer, invites Christians to make a manger in their hearts so that the Christ child can be born again in each person. And so this kind of birth or pregnancy imagery, it's very powerful, and it's a metaphor, but it describes something of the experience of God in the body and in the created world.
I think that's a perfect place for us to conclude this portion of the program. Thank you so much, Dr. Holmes, for being with us.
Thank you.
If I wasn't ready for Christmas and inhabiting Advent, I am ready now. Like, this was like watching and hearing my favorite Christmas movie in so many ways. So thank you so much again for being with us. Where can people find your work?
Available through your favorite bookseller.
Perfect. And tell us about a couple of your books.
So the main work is Flesh Made Word. And that's the book that, it's a theology of the incarnation using the writings of medieval women mystics as my primary source for thinking about inclusive incarnation.
Perfect. Well, I will definitely read it. I can promise you that.
Thank you.
Thank you again for opening our theological imaginations and being with us tonight. "This world is pregnant with God," said Blessed Angela of Foligno. This quote comes to us in rich and new ways as we journey through this season of Advent, the days leading up to the Feast of the Nativity, Christmas, days in which we hear prophets warn, coax, and encourage, days in which, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, hours of darkness outweigh hours of light. And yet we gather on nights like this one because somewhere deep in our bones we've been convinced that new possibilities lurk just beneath the surface. And goodness, if that is true. Theology Live is a ministry of Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church, a welcoming community of faith in the heart of Midtown Memphis. This episode of Theology Live was engineered and edited by Mr. Noah Glenn, who also composed our theme music. We offer special thanks to Dr. Emily Holmes, the staff here at J. Etkin Gallery, our photographer, Mr. Josh Colfer, and our caterers, Fork in the Road. Join us on February 8th, 2017, at historic Claiborne Temple with the Reverend Dr. Ebony Marshall Terman, Associate Professor at Yale Divinity School. Visit 901theology.com and follow us on Twitter at 901theology for updates about our live events. If you haven't already, subscribe to Theology Live on your preferred podcast platform. Then help enhance our digital visibility. Who wrote this? By reviewing us on iTunes. Thank you all very much.